This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour, the week in review.
Hello, this is Joel Hilliker, managing editor of the Philadelphia Trumpet News Magazine and your host for Trumpet Hour. Thanks for tuning in. This is our Week in Review program. Our staff has been busy scouring the news for important items all week, and we want to fill you in on some details of news that you may have heard about and tell you some other important news that you probably haven't heard about. I have with me here in the studio some of our writing staff. Brent Nachtigall is back with us.
Yep, hello.
Richard Palmer, we have via Skype from our office in the UK.
Good afternoon.
We've got Jeremiah Jacques here with us.
Hi there.
And Robert Morley.
Good to be here.
So our top story today, I'm not sure if you've heard this, but apparently there was a deal negotiated by the United States and five other nations with Iran over its nuclear program last week. Do you guys know about this?
Something.
This is the cover story of this week's Trumpet Weekly. This is our digest of the week's most important news. This is a free report that you can receive each week via email by subscribing at thetrumpet.com. And we've been talking about this story a lot on the radio, in our articles, but we're still trying to come to terms with just what happened here. And I believe we will be for some time to come. This week we have several items in the Trumpet Weekly that get into more of the details of this deal, the ramifications throughout the region and for the world. And I want to get into some robust discussion on this subject. I'm going to start by just throwing a couple of items out here. First, there's this report that came out on the speech by Iran's Ayatollah Khamenei in Tehran this past Saturday to his supporters. He vowed, this is just days after this deal was struck, he vowed to defy American policies in the region in spite of this deal. He said that U.S. policies in the region are 180 degrees opposite to Iran's. The speech is punctuated by the usual death to America, death to Israel chants from his supporters. John Kerry, the United States Secretary of State, says that he was disturbed by this hostility against the U.S. Now, this is the nation that we've gone through these negotiations with. This is the nation that we've made the deal with. They have absolutely, there's nothing to suggest that they are changing at all and that there's any interest in having any kind of an actual rapprochement with the United States. They are very opposed to the United States and openly so. And the United States, I mean, they haven't changed at all. You really have to give them credit for consistency, don't you? This is the way that they've been conducting themselves all along, and it's been the United States that's been bending over backwards to try to do something to try to make this deal happen. We have another article in this issue. I'm going to pitch this over to you, Robert, to talk about this, but the Los Angeles Times, why is the Iran deal bad? Think North Korea. There's a point here in this article that North Korea, when we made the deal with North Korea just a few years back, they never intended to give up anything. They never intended to honor their commitments at all. And really, that is the fundamental underpinning of this deal, is that we think that we have gotten them on our side. But you look at articles like this, you look at the behavior of this regime, and there's nothing to suggest that whatsoever. They have no intention of following through with what America hopes that they will.
Look, when you consider this deal, it all gets down to trust. You can, as much as President Obama wants to say there's verification, there's inspectors, when you get into the details, this agreement, just like the one with North Korea back in 1994, it's all built on trust. Do we trust the Iranians to follow through with their commitments? Do we trust that they have changed, that they have renounced their intent to obtain nuclear weapons? And this is somewhat disturbing because, as many analysts have brought out, this deal between Iran and the United States is eerily similar to the deal that was eked out between North Korea and the United States. You can take a look at how there were sanctions in place. They were relieved that there was oil component involved. And in that deal with North Korea, like this one today, the United States even came in and said, we'll help you build peaceful nuclear energy. We'll help you build, develop your peaceful nuclear program. And there'll be inspections. There'll be the International Atomic Energy Agency. They will run the inspections just like they will, or they will be going forward with this deal with Iran. And what happened? Well, in hindsight, we couldn't trust them. And there's so many similarities. If a country wants to deceive you, Iran is a big place. It has plenty of locations. It can hide a covert program. The North Koreans were able to do it in a much smaller territory than Iran. So the question is, can we trust the Iranians? Can we trust the mullahs who chant death to America?
This quote from this Los Angeles Times article, the larger problem is that like North Korea, Iran is a big country. If the government wants to hide something, it will likely succeed. Compliance depends on voluntary cooperation. And look at how many times they have violated their commitments in the past, and they've deceived IAEA inspectors. This says this is not a good sign. It suggests that Iran, like North Korea, is likely to play a game of cat and mouse with inspectors, and that if it does cheat, as North Korea did, the world will again discover it is too late to do anything about it.
We have to remember that all the nuclear sites that have been discovered have not been from the Iranians coming forward and saying, look, this is part of our program. These are ones that were discovered by embedded spy assets by the West. So that gives you a pretty good idea of their intent, I think.
Another piece of the puzzle. Brent, you have something for us.
Sure. There was something that came out this week, Sunday it was, or just this past Sunday, about Article 10 of this deal. And that is that the nuclear facilities of Iran, the ones that we know about, will actually be protected by the Western powers if it looks like there is any active sabotage coming out against them. I'll read the deal itself. This is under the heading Reactors, Fuels, Facilities, and Processes. It stipulates that world powers and Iran will foster cooperation through training and workshops to strengthen Iran's ability to protect against and respond to nuclear security threats, including sabotage, as well as to enable effective systems, and so on and so forth. So this question was posed to Senator Kerry yesterday. Well, what does this mean? Does this mean that if Israel decides that the threat of Iran developing a nuclear weapon has become so close to being fulfilled that they need to act forcefully, militarily, on Iran's nuclear sites, that we will actually protect Iran against our ally Israel? Now, Senator Kerry then went on to say that, Secretary of State Kerry, he was a senator before, he went on to say, well, this clause was mainly there to protect against cyber attacks of their nuclear facilities and things like that, and that we will protect them against that. But then it was reposed to him by presidential hopeful Marco Rubio. He said, well, in the event, again, that Israel is the one that's doing this cyber attack, would we stop this cyber attack from taking place? Secretary of State Kerry, he said that the chances of Israel and America actually coming to a disagreement over whether they should act or not were so slim. Israel would never act unless it had the approval of Western powers, including the United States. So obviously we wouldn't protect them. Now, this is a scary thought, because all through this process, we have seen disagreement between Israel and the United States over Iran's nuclear program.
One other bit that I'd like you to talk about is this fact that the United States is not allowed to even set foot in Iran.
Right. What was outlaid yesterday in the Senate hearing was that there is a lot of trust being placed in the International Atomic Energy Agency. They are the ones that are going to have the boots on the ground looking at these suspected sites. And they are the ones that are going to look into the past or possible military dimensions of Iran's past. There is one key facility in Parchin. It's a military site that Israel suspects did have nuclear work going on at this site. And they wanted to resolve this. And of course, it was part of the agreement that this site, it would be resolved whether they did, in fact, you know, conduct military work here. But the United States cannot put its boots on the ground there to check it out. Everything has to be run through the IAEA. So how this is going to work out, and there were senators shocked on this by from both sides, Republicans, Democrats yesterday, that the IAEA was actually going to get a sample from the site from Iran, and then they will test that sample to see whether it has any traces of radioactive material there. So in that case, it's like the specimen is given over by the perpetrator. It's, I don't know, it's so, I can't explain it, that they would be allowed to do this. A lot of trust is placed on the IAEA. Of course, you can understand this. In times past, with South Africa's nuclear program, when it was shut down in the early 90s, the IAEA had the responsibility of going in there and checking the sites out. And it was success. They did report back to the Western powers and say, yeah, we are, our fears have been allayed. They have got rid of everything. But then the senators asked Senator Kerry, well, in what reality is South Africa like Iran? I mean, South Africa wasn't trying to do this in a very covert manner, but Iran has proven they would be. So they would deliberately deceive the IAEA. And part of the IAEA inspectors, the group that goes on the ground there, like you said, none of them are allowed to be American citizens. So who's to say these IAEA scientists wouldn't kind of color the truth if they are from a power like Russia or China or something like that, or someplace like that, that is actually, you know, rooting for Iran, it looks like, in this deal. The U.S. will have no way to verify itself that Iran is not engaging in suspect nuclear activities.
Very disturbing part of the picture here. Did you have something, Jeremiah?
Yeah, I just wanted to mention one other parallel between the Iran deal and the North Korea deal, which is the response of the neighbors. After North Korea broke the terms of their nuclear deal and they developed nuclear weapons and they began to threaten other nations, you saw a lot of its neighbors, especially Japan, really beginning to ramp up their own defenses, ramp up their military, abandoning pacifism. They said, now that North Korea is nuclear, we've got to be able to defend against this. And now the same thing is happening with Iran's neighbors, Saudi Arabia in particular. The failed deal with North Korea made Asia more militarized and more dangerous. And now the deal with Iran is on track to do the same thing in the Middle East.
Report in this week's Trumpet Weekly from Reuters from this past Tuesday, Saudi Arabia considers its own nuclear options after Iran deal. It says one likely Saudi Arabian response to the deal, its biggest enemy Iran has struck with world powers, is to accelerate its own nuclear power plans, creating an atomic infrastructure it could one day seek to weaponize. It quotes the head of a Saudi news channel saying, I think Saudi Arabia would seriously try to get the bomb if Iran did. It's just like India and Pakistan. The Pakistanis said for years they didn't want one, but when India got it, so did they. And this is obviously something that would come at a high cost to Saudi-U.S. relations. And President Obama has said that this is a bluff. There are actually a lot of people saying that it's a bluff and that there isn't going to be an arms race. Now, we don't necessarily believe Saudi Arabia is going to get nuclear weapons, but I think those statements really are telling in terms of what they think is going to happen because of this deal. They look at the terms that Iran has been granted by Western powers, and they don't seem to be particularly convinced that by President Obama's assurances that this is going to keep us safer. And it does show America's diminishing influence in the region. It shows Saudi Arabia can't trust the United States. It's looking for other solutions. It's looking for other means of countering Iranian influence. And that's where you get into things like, you know, Arab alliances, and that opens the door for Germany to become more involved and so on. Just so many ramifications, so many aspects of this that are we're going to be watching play out in the time ahead. This is also the subject of the television program recorded by The Trumpet's editor-in-chief, Gerald Fleury. It's up on thetrumpet.com today. It's called the America-Iran Nuclear Agreement. This weekly program is The Key of David, and this is a very sobering episode of this program. The article that accompanies that program is also up on the Trumpet site today. It's called Negotiating Human Survival. And this is an article that's part of our next edition of the Trumpet magazine, the September edition of the Trumpet, which we finished yesterday. It's the first in a whole set of articles in a special report that makes up a significant part of the issue on this Iranian nuclear deal. Stephen Fleury has an article crowning the king of the Middle East. I have an article about how this deal will change history. Brad McDonald has an article called Fire from the Sky. We talked about that on the program this past Wednesday. This is a big story, and I do encourage you to visit thetrumpet.com to read these articles to get a better sense of just how historic, how significant this deal really is. Now, we took a little bit more time than I had hoped on that subject, so we're going to stay in the Middle East, look at any other important news from that region by asking Brent, give us the overview.
Okay, quickly. Well, the ink was barely dried on the agreement, and there was already a delegation from Germany that was sent over there to Iran to look at the economic impact this deal could have between the two countries, see if they can increase trade. At the same time, an Iranian minister said that $2 billion worth of deals have already been worked out between nations of the EU and Iran. Now, the deal hasn't even been fully ratified yet by the individual countries. It's still got to go through the EU's parliament, still got to go through the US Congress. And yet, there's people queuing up, led by Germany, and then following France will be next week. The EU foreign chief, Federica Mogherini, she's going there next week as well. They all want to jump in on the cash. The cash cow is going to be Iran for the next few years, and everyone wants to get a piece of the action. So look out for nations across the world, probably apart from the U.S. There might be a few U.S. nations trying to get there, but I think that the Iranians would be much more willing to deal with China, Russia, and the EU than the U.S. So that was pretty big.
The big story from the Middle East this week.
The big story has been breaking over the last couple of days, and it's about Turkey entering the fray in the Syrian civil war, particularly in its fight against ISIS. Now, this is huge. For the past 2 years, Turkey hasn't done much in Syria at all to try and counter ISIS's mad reign through that country, killing, I think the total number right now of people killed in the Syrian civil war, and then you tack on ISIS on that, is over 200,000 people. So this is barbaric, and yet Turkey has sat back. Now, Turkey has been accused of virtually supporting ISIS by not... by allowing ISIS foreign nationals to support ISIS by coming through their porous border, going straight from Turkey, from Europe through Turkey down into Syria and then fighting against ISIS. Now, that might have been true, but it stopped. As of this week, there was a terrorist attack in southeastern Turkey and 32 people were killed. This was an ISIS attack on Turkish nationals, and it seems to have really motivated Turkey to change their game plan. Today, there was a police raid involving 5,000 police officers. Over 200 terrorists or suspected terrorists were nabbed inside Turkey. So this was a raid that they had probably been planning. They had intelligence on these guys, and they finally nabbed them. On Wednesday, Turkey agreed to, after a phone call with President Obama, agreed to open up the Incirlik air base to be used for attacks on ISIS as well. Now, this was huge. The United States has been wanting to use this base. It's a NATO base on Turkish property. It's only 400 miles from the border of Syria, so you can see that if jets are going to fly into Syria to have airstrikes on ISIS, this would be much easier than flying from the Gulf, which is, 2,000-mile round trip from the Gulf states. And that's what they were doing. But now Turkey has opened up that base to be used for these attacks. So, and then today, Turkish jets were actually used for the first time against ISIS targets. While they didn't fly into Syrian territory, they did fire from Turkish territory and take out ISIS targets on the border. Three targeted strikes. Now, the Prime Minister, Davutoğlu of Turkey, he came out and said that this was not a point operation. This is a process. It is not limited to one day or to one region. The slightest movement threatening Turkey will be retaliated against in the strongest possible way. So Turkey is entering the fight against ISIS.
So what does this mean? What can we expect to change? I'll tell you, Islamic State, they are not afraid of anybody.
No, that's what Max Boot called it. I've got his article around here somewhere. It's interesting. He said he's an author for Commentary Magazine, and he says, ISIS may well come to regret the day it chose to mess with Turkey. When you think about Turkey...
Biggest military in the region.
Definitely. You look at the countries that border Syria. You have Iraq, you have Jordan, you have Israel. Jordanian army is not going to come across the border and attack ISIS. They are going to sit tight and defend their border. The Iraq, already the border between Iraq and Syria is gone, so that one doesn't count. Then you've got Israel. Israel is not going to lead a ground war against any Arab power because it would do to the region, and all the Arab powers would come against them. Then you've got Turkey. Now, Turkey could flood down there with troops. I don't know if they're going to do this or not, but they could flood down there with their army, and they would make short work of ISIS. It wouldn't take that long. A number of commentators have said that. Now, the importance of this, when we look at it prophetically, is we know that Turkey is going to be part of an alliance that does counter Iran. It's going to be part of the Psalm 83 alliance. It's been talked about quite a lot, that partners up with Germany, includes the Gulf states. It also includes Syria. And we've been watching for Syria to flip-flop from supporting Iran or being one of Iran's minions to actually changing sides and lining up with the Gulf states and Turkey. Now, the question is, why hasn't Turkey been involved inside Syria yet? There's two reasons. The first is Turkey has a couple of threats. One of them is the Kurdish region on their east, south and east. There's a huge population of ethnic Kurds there that want to break away from Turkey and become their own state. There's huge populations of Kurds in northern Iraq and Syria as well, right on the border between the other Kurdish area in Turkey. Now, in the fight against ISIS, you've seen the number one power that has been effective has been the Kurds fighting in Syria and fighting in Iraq. They are gobbling up territory inside Syria as ISIS is. They're actually taking some territory, and Turkey fears that if the Kurds become strong on their southern border, then the border, the adjacent area on Turkish territory, they'll become strong there too, and they might be able to create the state. So they haven't wanted to act because they saw ISIS as keeping the Kurdish problem, their own Kurdish problem, at bay. Now, the other reason they didn't act is because ISIS was fighting against Bashar al-Assad. Bashar al-Assad and the Turks do not get on. So the big point is, if Turkey is going in to try and defeat ISIS, and they're actually, it looks like they're going to be on the same side as Assad, they obviously think that their incursion is going to end with Assad losing power, or else why would they put forth the effort to destroy one enemy at the sake of bolstering another one?
All right, thank you, Brent. We will zip over now to the UK and our man over there, Richard Palmer. Can you give us the important news from Europe this week?
Greek banks finally opened. If you've lived in Greece, you'd be spending the last 2 weeks living by on whatever drips you could get out of an ATM, but they finally opened their doors this week, and Greece passed the last bits of legislation that it needed as part of the conditions for bailout funds. So now we're moving forward into more long-term negotiations about loans. So it looks like we're moving beyond the euro crisis and the Greek crisis, at least for now. It will be back, but we're finishing this chapter. Well, mayors from major cities all over the world gathered at the Vatican for a two-day environmental conference. And that was kind of a rallying moment ahead of some big climate negotiations that are coming up in Paris. And Pope Francis spoke there and used that meeting to continue his bid to have the Catholic Church kind of in charge of solving the world's climate problems and economic problems. And there's a very powerful article in this Trumpet Weekly that talks about that that's well worth reading.
Excellent. And the big story from Europe this week?
Well, the big story I'd like to talk about is a remarkable letter from French President François Hollande that he wrote in a French newspaper last Sunday. And Just one quote that kind of sums up the theme of this letter is, what threatens us is not too much Europe, but too little Europe. And it was a remarkable call coming from a head of state for Europe to better integrate and to get together in the wake of these financial crises, like we saw in Greece just very recently. So he talked about having a parliament for just the Eurozone. So this is a brand new parliamentary organization. He talked about having a shared budget, which means at least some level of shared taxation, some level of shared spending. So he's talking about a common Eurozone government. And then there are some additional aspects of this that are also remarkable. He talked about how, you know, there's 19 different Eurozone nations. That's just the Eurozone. That's not the whole EU. And we saw how long it took them to come to an agreement on Greece and how hard it is to negotiate with that large number of countries. So Hollande talked about having a vanguard of nations moving forward towards this Eurozone government. So a smaller group that's ready to move much faster than the rest. And then Manuel Valls, the French prime minister, came out and said, and actually put forward some names as to who should be in this vanguard, and said that the EU's six founding members should be there: France, Germany, Italy, Belgium, Luxembourg, and the Netherlands. And so we're seeing this push from someone very senior to the kind of core Europe that we've talked about for a long time at the trumpet. And this isn't just an idea from François Hollande. It's something that there have been more and more calls from recently from European politicians. I think it was just last month the five different presidents of the EU put together a set of proposals for a more closely integrated Eurozone. And they didn't go quite as far as Hollande, but there were concrete proposals calling for steps in that direction. But this, I think, is the first time I can remember that an EU head of state has made such an explicit call for his fellow nations and even his own nation to give up sovereignty and form this type of common government.
Yeah, that should not be a surprise to trumpet readers at all, should it? We've had, I guess, Gerald Fleury's been talking specifically about how what happened in Greece is going to increase the pressure on Europe to whittle this unwieldy monstrosity down to 10 nations. You know, it takes a crisis to be able to put the pressure on to do something so radical as this.
Yes, absolutely. And it has been happening exactly the way that he said it would in late 2008 at the start of the euro crisis, with exactly those pressures pushing it forward. And even well before 2008 and even before the euro, saying that the European Union is too big, it can't get things done. Anytime there's going to be problems in the world, you're going to see calls to form a much more tightly knit group.
Hollande calls for vanguard of states to lead strengthened Eurozone. This article is in this week's Trumpet Weekly, our informative report that we provide each week with the most significant stories that we can find. I want to encourage you to subscribe to this free report. Just go online to thetrumpet.com to subscribe to the Trumpet Weekly. Coming up next, we will have news from Asia and America, and later on, our lightning round of important headlines from all our panelists. We'll be back in a moment.
This is Trumpet Hour with Joel Hilliker.
You're listening to our Week in Review program, looking at the big stories from around the world over this past week. We're going to turn now to Asia and Jeremiah Jacques. We'll start with the overview of important headlines from Asia this week.
Well, first, there was a report published about a Chinese military drill that apparently simulated a siege on Taiwan's presidential office. China does not recognize Taiwan as a separate nation. The Chinese instead consider Taiwan a part of China. And at the Trumpet, we've long said that Taiwan is destined to become an official part of China. So this simulation really looks like it could be leading in that direction. We also saw an announcement from South Korea this week. They said that South Korea will not join the United States in imposing sanctions on Russia, despite a lot of pressure from America to do so. Last year, President Obama said that the so-called international community was unified against Russia over its moves in eastern Ukraine there. But it was not true. China did not support the U.S.'s moves. India didn't support them. Several other countries decided to stand with Russia instead of joining the U.S. And now one of America's staunchest allies, South Korea, is right alongside these other nations saying, sorry, America, we don't stand with you. We're okay with Russia.
All right. What would you say was the biggest story this week?
Well, the big story is about a trend underway in Russia where military fervor and a zeal to fight for the nation is just greatly intensifying among the young people. There's a report in the Trumpet Weekly by Medusa, which is a Latvian newspaper, and it goes into great depth about the success the Russian government is having in just stirring up this military fervor among Russian youth and preparing these young Russians to give their lives for the motherland. This Medusa report says, support for the army and the desire to serve the nation have reached an all-time high in Russia. And it goes on to say that just in the last year, the number of applications submitted to the military universities has doubled. It was already very high, and now it's doubled. And at this point, you've got 6 men applying for every single available position. And among women, there are 30 women applying for every position available.
Is that because there's more militant women or fewer positions?
Fewer positions. Maybe a little of each. But what it means is that the military is able to take just the creme de la creme, just the very top applicants. And it means that the Russian military and all of its activities are enjoying unprecedented support among the Russian people. And so kids as young as 5 are signing up for these programs. There are thousands of them all over the country. And the aims of the program are very ambitious. From the Medusa report, it says the aims are to make citizens feel great responsibility for the fate of their country, to prepare them to defend the motherland, and to spark interest in the history of Russia and make Russians proud of historical heroes. So this story is really significant because of the insight that it gives us into Russia's resurgence. It shows that the populace totally backs President Vladimir Putin as he steers the nation toward this new assertive sort of direction, this new aggressive expansionist even path that he's been taking it on. It's also significant because of how it compares to the United States. A Gallup poll from earlier this year showed that a minority of Americans would fight for the country if we were attacked. And that number is falling all the time. It's well below 50% now. And that's just because pride in the country among Americans is dwindling. There's political infighting that keeps on dividing us and subdividing us and subdividing us. And Americans, for the most part, are not proud of the country. We are not willing to risk our lives to support it, for the most part. And that's reflected in the United States military. The American military has gone through times fairly recently where it was forced to basically accept anyone who would walk through the door, just because so few people were interested in enlisting. And so they greatly lowered the recruitment standards. Now we are again turning away more applicants, but that's not because more people and more qualified people are applying. It's just because there are efforts to shrink the military down. So apart from that, though, the American public do not, by and large, have a favorable view of the military. They don't take it seriously. They don't believe in the troops or in the campaigns. And it's leading to a lot of demoralization among the troops.
Yeah, it seems like there's a bit of a divide between, say, it seems like people in general really do support the troops, but this idea that we don't have anything really worth fighting for, a high level of disenfranchisement with the military campaigns that we've been involved in and seeing the way that they've kind of fallen to pieces before our eyes creates a real problem, particularly for recruiters, I would think. So the recruiters in the United States would love to have the kind of climate that Vladimir Putin enjoys.
Yeah, that's exactly right. But it's quite the opposite. So when you look at what's happening in Russia, this intensifying fervor for the military and for the motherland, this jingoism and militarism and nationalism, this eagerness of young people to lay down their lives for the country, it really looks like exactly the opposite of what you have here in the United States. And in my view, this is a clear sign of just another indication of the decline of America's era of global dominance and of the rise of those nations that really long to bring a conclusive end to that era.
Yeah, so many signs of exactly what you're describing. If you have to connect the dots, add it up, and recognize that the world is very different than it was 10, 20 years ago, and it's going to change even more rapidly when these trends play out. Well, thank you very much for that. We're going to turn now to Anglo-America, and for that we'll turn to trumpet writer Robert Morley. Can you give us the overview of headlines this week?
Sure. This week, Judicial Watch obtained new documents showing that the IRS was, surprise, surprise, targeting conservatives through tax audits. The IRS is finally complying with some of those court orders requiring them to release documents. And what they're finding is that, yes, in the lead up to the last presidential election, they were targeting critics of the Obama administration. What these documents show is that of the groups that the IRS flagged for surveillance, 83% were right-leaning groups, and of the groups selected for audit, 100% were right-leaning groups. So there was no targeting going on there, no smidgen of corruption at all at the IRS. Then also this week, the White House began its Rethink Discipline campaign, and it began this campaign by tweeting to its 6.5 million followers that the number of kids suspended from schools in America in a year could fill up 45 Super Bowls. So the White House here is highlighting a disturbing problem. America's schools are in trouble. And as the White House is taking great pains to highlight, it's the black and minority students that are the ones that are most often being kicked out of classes for behavioral issues. And the White House says this is due to entrenched institutional racism. So the White House is planning or pushing a ban on all suspensions of students that are for nonviolent issues. So the question is, will this help fix American schools or not? And I'd encourage listeners to go to thetrumpet.com and look for a future article on this, probably Monday.
Go to thetrumpet.com and look for a future article.
And look for an article on this on Monday. How about that?
Yeah, and we need to talk about this more for sure. So the big story that you wanted to hit this week.
Well, I think the big story this week was that reports have emerged that President Obama is planning more executive actions on immigration. The administration wants to expand a waiver program that will allow more illegal aliens to remain in the country. If you recall, back in 2013, President Obama issued an executive order that some people called unconstitutional that allowed illegal immigrants that had a U.S. citizen spouse or parent to stay in the country instead of having to leave before they applied for a permit to legally stay in the United States. But now, supposedly, this rule will expand eligibility to a whole host of other categories of illegal immigrants. What has been leaked so far says that illegal immigrants that are allowed to stay will now include immigrants with extended family members. So beyond mother, father, parent, children relationship. Now, if you have aunts or uncles or cousins that are citizens, you'll be allowed to stay here. Also, any illegal immigrant who has a job and is being sponsored by that employer and that employer wants to stay here, they'll be allowed to stay in the country illegally. Also, this will include any illegal immigrants determined to be quote unquote special, whatever that means. And also immigrants that are part of the diversity visa program and their spouses and children. So they will be allowed to stay as well. So here's massive potential expansion of President Obama's 2013 executive action. Just for some context, Jessica Vaughn, she's a director of policy studies at the Center for Immigration Studies, a conservative-leaning group. She said that basically this proposal blows the deterrence factor for immigrating legally out of the water. So it just blows it out of the water. Why would immigrants come to the United States legally if this goes through? And she calls it a slap in the face to the many legal immigrants who abide by the law and follow the process and wait their turn. And she's warning that we're going to see massive expansion and fraud regarding marriage categories, marrying for the green card. And she says that, you know, we're already giving out over a million green cards per year. And the green card, as our listeners know, I'm sure they're aware of that, that's the golden ticket. Once you get that, you can apply for welfare and tax credits and entitlements and all kinds of things. And she's expecting this to greatly be expanded.
This whole policy is just really putting a lot of America's economy, American lives at risk.
Right. It comes at a time when, let's not forget here that on average, once every 12 days, an American citizen is murdered by an illegal immigrant. Now think about that. Once every 12 days, an illegal that should have been deported. And we have sanctuary cities around this nation that refuse to deport illegals. And they're putting the welfare of illegals above American citizens. It's very disturbing.
Well, thank you for bringing that to our attention. You can find Robert's future article on thetrumpet.com. You can go there to receive a free subscription to our weekly news report. And that has this Washington Free Beacon article, Obama Admin Plans More Executive Action on Immigration, in this week's edition of The Trumpet Weekly. That and the other stories that we've been talking about on the program today are in that edition. We're going to finish up the program next with our lightning round of important news from all our panelists. Coming up next.
You're listening to Trumpet Hour, the Week in Review.
It's time now for our lightning round. One last look at some of the headlines from this last week that caught our attention. We will begin with Richard.
I would like to talk about hedgehog, dynamic mongoose, and lightning strike. These are the names of the three military operations that Latvia, Lithuania, and Estonia have been holding. We have an article this week in the Trumpet Weekly called Europe Puts Its Finger on the Trigger, that gives a great summary of the way that Europe has been responding to Russia's aggression in Ukraine. So, for example, military spending is set to increase by over $50 billion. That's an increase of almost 50% since 2013. And then, as this article points out, this is happening in a time of debt, of cuts, of austerity. And EU nations are slashing their welfare budgets at the same time that they're increasing their military. And that would be unthinkable 5 years ago. And it also makes the point that it's not just the countries right next door to Russia that are increasing their spending and that are holding these kind of military drills. Germany, for example, is increasing its spending by $8.5 billion by 2019, and France by $3.5 billion. And then you've got a crackdown in civil liberties. And, for example, France recently introduced their French Patriot Act, as it's been labeled. And so with the Trumpet, we've talked for several years about how fear of Russia would change Europe, how it would force them to unite. And already we're seeing a pretty significant reaction from Europe to what Russia's been doing in Ukraine.
All right. Thank you, Richard. We'll go now to Jeremiah.
Well, Kyrgyzstan is a country that we don't hear about too much. But this week, Kyrgyzstan announced that it is tearing up a long-running cooperation agreement with the United States. The United States and Kyrgyzstan have been closely cooperating ever since 1993, just after the Soviet Union, which Kyrgyzstan had been a part of, collapsed. And so for over 20 years, the U.S. presence there in Kyrgyzstan was by far the largest manifestation of American power in Central Asia. But now that is over. And it's all because Russia did not approve of Kyrgyzstan's cooperation with America. Russia pressured Kyrgyzstan to kick America out. And just last year, they shut down the Manas transit military base there. And now this cooperation agreement is shredded. And Kyrgyzstan is rapidly drifting back into Russia's orbit.
All right. Thank you very much. We'll turn now to Brent.
Well, after years of alignment with Shiite Iran, the Palestinian Hamas group is bidding for Sunni patronage from Saudi Arabia in a dramatic shift to its geostrategic orientation. That was the first line in an article in the Times of Israel entitled, "In Hamas's Embrace of Sunni Saudi Arabia, a Slap to Iran." So you have this meeting that took place this week with the head of the Hamas group, Khalid Mashal. He went to Saudi Arabia and met with King Salem, of Saudi Arabia. Also with him was a large delegation of Hamas people, including the Turkish-based official of Hamas, Saleh al-Ruri. Now, he's the guy that actually orchestrated the attack that started off the Gaza war a year ago when those three Israeli teens were murdered. So you have this meeting taking place in Saudi Arabia when we know that Iran is actually the traditional supporter of Hamas. And it looks like this one-off meeting there is going to be a change there. It looks like they're actually going to see if that Saudi Arabia can help them. Now, an Iranian MP called this move a mistake. They didn't like the fact that Hamas was going to Saudi Arabia. And we're obviously concerned about this because Bible prophecy talks about, again, in Psalm 83, talks about the Philistines, or that area that is the territory that the Hamas terrorists are in the Gaza Strip, that occupies the same territory that the Philistines did anciently. So we're looking for a switch of allegiance between Hamas and Iran to Hamas and the Sunni states. So this really does back up that.
All right, thank you, Brent. I'll slip a headline in here. You remember not too long ago, the biggest hack in history, one of the most damaging cyber thefts in U.S. government history, what appeared to be the Chinese getting access to, what was it, 20 million plus accounts of American federal employees and so on. This is a huge, huge attack on America. And what is the United States going to do? Well, here's the news from the Washington Post this week. U.S. decides against publicly blaming China for data hack. Months after the discovery of a massive breach of U.S. government personnel records, the Obama administration has decided against publicly blaming China for the intrusion, in part out of a reluctance to reveal the evidence that American investigators have assembled. That's the reason, they say. We have chosen not to make any official assertions about attribution at this point, according to a senior administration official. So one of the biggest hacks in history, and China suffers absolutely no consequences. Remember, it was just April 1st that Obama drew a cyber red line in the sand. He signed an executive order authorizing sanctions against individuals or entities who carry out cyber attacks and cyber espionage against the U.S. He said, starting today, we're giving notice to those who pose significant threats to our security or economy by damaging our critical infrastructure, disrupting or hijacking our computer networks, or stealing the trade secrets of American companies, or the personal information of American citizens for profit. As of today, the United States has a new tool to protect our nations, our companies, and our citizens, and in the days and years ahead, we will use it. But we're not using it. We're not going to use it. There's this massive, massive hack, no consequences whatsoever, just a remarkable example of America's broken will. Robert Morley, take it away, the last one.
Well, in much more positive news, South Carolina continues to impress the country by showing America the way to have peaceful race relations. This is a story that Jeremiah Jacques wrote about earlier this week, but in Columbia on Saturday, there was a rally where white supremacists faced off against the new Black Panthers. And in the midst of this protest, among some people even getting arrested, a picture emerged from the demonstration that showed a Black police officer helping an elderly white supremacist who was being overcome by heat exhaustion. And that picture has gone viral with many, many people sharing it through the internet. And on that picture, you see this unidentified white man wearing this T-shirt emblazoned with a swastika and symbols associated with the neo-Nazis, and he's clearly having health trouble. It looks like he's about to faint, and here we have this officer, Leroy Smith, propping this man up, helping him up the stairs to get out of the sun and into the shade. And this photo, I think, went viral because of the example of forgiveness and compassion that was set by Smith, who again was Black, helping this white supremacist. And later when Smith was asked about the photo, he said, "That's just who we are, in South Carolina. I mean, what a good example this officer set. And it's the same example that Trumpet magazine editor Gerald Fleury drew attention to with the African Methodist Episcopal Church and their response after 9 of their members were killed by that psychopath, Dylan Roof. And at that time, he said that that was one of the most amazing stories in American history. And he said that the relatives of the victims of that church shooting showed the whole world the solution to race relations. And I think we're seeing kind of the same picture emerge here with this police officer. So if you haven't yet, go to thetrumpet.com and watch Gerald Fleury's Kia David television program, Charleston, South Carolina, How to Solve Race Relations.
That is our cover story of our September edition of The Trumpet as well, How to Solve Race Relations. You should be able to read that on thetrumpet.com. I'm Joel Hilliker. We're coming to the end of Trumpet Hour. Remember, you can find us at thetrumpet.com online, and you can get a free subscription to this weekly news report, The Trumpet Weekly. The stories that we've talked about in the program today are in that report. You can also get a free subscription to our monthly news magazine, The Philadelphia Trumpet. Send us your thoughts or your questions by emailing letters@thetrumpet.com. Follow us on Twitter @@thetrumpet_com. Find us on Facebook or Google Plus by searching for The Philadelphia Trumpet. Thank you, gentlemen. Thank you to Brent Noctegal, Jeremiah Jacques, Robert Morley, and Richard Palmer.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
And thanks to our technical staff, Dwight Falk and Josh Sloan. And I'll leave you with the words of Minion McLaughlin. Minion McLaughlin. Don't be yourself. Be someone a little nicer. Thank you for joining us on Trumpet Hour. It's been a pleasure. Until next time, keep watching your world.
You've been listening to Trumpet Hour on The Voice, 101.3 KPCG, and on the web at kpcg.fm.